Welcome, Parish Orphans and Retrogrades, on Rumble almost exclusively, or perhaps exclusively. Today is a very special show because at long last, Dr. E. Michael Jones, operative for the last roughly 40 years, doing good work in the vineyard, joins me to talk about matters that are dear to my heart, like Christian patriarchy and its subversion, and related matters that have come to my attention only in the last couple of years, like the Jewish revolutionary spirit and so-called Christian anti-Semitism. But at long last, like Rogozhin and Mishkin, Dr. Jones and I have been in similar circles, sort of circling each other. We get to have a conversation. I'm genuinely happy about it. Welcome so much to be here, Dr. E. Michael Jones.
Thank you. Thank you. Good to be here. Good to be here, Tim.
Yeah, thanks for coming on after. I think I first came across your work like 6.5 years ago. Didn't know what to make of it, and have found you to be, over the last 4 years, 4.5 years, utterly vindicated after some initial skepticism on my part. So thanks for coming on and, you know, answering my questions. You've been at this for a long, long time before it became fashionable to notice the things that you have been noticing for 40 years.
That's true. That's true. One of them was a Jewish question. It was kind of lonely when the Jewish revolutionary spirit came out. It came out in 2009. But I did it because I felt that it was unavoidable. And I think that people are coming around to that point of view. It's just difficult to talk about the situation in the church or in the world without bringing up that topic.
It is. And I have long feared, as a trained philosopher, I've long feared over-application, under-determination, applying too little evidence to too broad a conclusion. And that is always a danger when we come to our conclusions. But more and more, I guess my change over the last couple of years, and this book published by you at Fidelity Press, has really helped me, as not only a Catholic man, but a philosopher, to feel that we're not actually being underdetermined in our application of the evidence. So let me say this. And another topic that you've dealt with is libido dominandi. And this is a lot of work. I haven't read Libido Dominandi, though I always knew you were right about this when people summarized your work on this area for me. And this is an area that is dear to my heart: Christian patriarchy, feminism, the fact that our society now and our church has turned gynocentric, for lack of a better term, and that it afflicts 99% of the households, trad, no, you know, however you want to divide Roman Catholicism, it afflicts all of them, even the trads, even, you know, SSPX folks or set of a contest, they tend to lean that way too, because society has been orchestrated in an anti-patriarchal way. And your work, I plan to read Libido Dominandi, but your work, I think is a very, very nice originary statement. My audience is already familiar with the concept that the Christian household patriarchy has already been subverted by a kind of manufactured feminism. The original sin is feminism, so that didn't have to be manufactured, aside from by the serpent himself. But specifically in the middle 19th century, it was specially manufactured. And you use this term libido dominandi, meaning that a already disordered, fallible, weak men's libido has been weaponized as a means of political subjugation, the political and cultural subjugation by Jewish power. That's sort of the final note in the song. Can you explain why this is such a key feature of subjugation, libido dominandi?
Yeah. If you go back to, let's say, a seminal document like the City of God by St. Augustine, he says there are basically two options. One is, Love and service, that's the city of God. That's the constitution of the city of God. Love your fellow neighbor and serve him. The city of man has to be the opposite of that. So what's the opposite of love and service? It's a desire to dominate your fellow man for your benefit. And that's what the term libido dominandi means. That's how St. Augustine uses it in his book. So it's always there. But what happened over this period of time is, the means whereby you can do this became more and more sophisticated. So whenever you have a situation of domination, if the person's aware of being dominated, then there's going to be resistance. That's right. Natural. So the best way to dominate people is to mobilize their own desires, their own disordered desires. And these go all the way back, as you mentioned, to Adam and Eve. The sense, the woman's frailty in terms of reason, the man's weakness with regard to the women, to the woman, it got manipulated by the devil, and it was a catastrophe that, you know, is with us still. The story of Samson and Delilah is similar, and this is one of the archetypes of this type of idea. The man was strong, not only strong, he was the strongest man in Israel, and he could not be conquered, could not be defeated in battle. But there was another weakness that he had, and that was lust, and that's what happened to him. He succumbed to his own desires. So I started the book with the French Revolution, not because lust began then, but because I think this was one of the first places where you had a deliberate political mobilization of sexual desire. And the man who did it was the Marquis de Sade. And the issue was, what are we going to do about the uprising in the West called the Vendée, from the people from the Vendée who want to restore the French king, and so on and so forth. And so he gave a speech in which he said, yet once more, Frenchmen, and basically he said, we need to arouse passion because that's the basis of revolution. And we will arouse passion by let's exhibit women naked in the theaters. This is what he said. Well, you got a technological problem here, okay? If it's a big theater, you can get a lot of men in, but they're so far away, you can't really get the effect. If it's a small theater, you can see the naked women, but you're not mobilizing a lot of people. That's a technological problem, and it's always been a problem. And so the French Revolution began in many ways at the Palais Royal when they started promoting pornography. And so pornography was being promoted by the Duke of Orléans, who was the king's cousin. He changed his name to Philippe Égalité after the revolution, and then he got his head chopped off for his pains. But at this point, you see the beginning of it as a political mobilization. Over that period of time, what we had was a huge outburst of technology. We're talking about the 19th century. The middle of the 19th century, you had a Frenchman by the name of Daguerre, who created the camera and basically took pictures. Within minutes, practically, of the invention of the camera, some guy went out and got some woman to take off her clothes and take pictures of her naked. So pornography is always a function of technology, and that was one of the steps forward. And then we had another step forward with the motion picture, the moving picture. And the place that became famous for that was Hollywood. And Hollywood was dominated by Jews. Jews created it. Jews control it to this day. And as soon as they started the motion picture, it had a tremendous effect because it established, you're in a darkened theater. It gives you the sense that you're really there, even as primitive as it was. Again, as with Daguerre, it's basically within years of the technology coming into being, the possibility of exploiting it as a vehicle for pornography took place. And the Jews were in the forefront of this. And by the mid-1920s, Americans in general were upset. America is Protestant, Catholic, Jew. At this point, you had the Protestant hegemony over America. And they asked Will Hayes, the former Postmaster General, to do something, and he failed. And at that point, they turned to the Catholics, and the Catholics organized a boycott. of Hollywood films. Cardinal Doherty called the boycott in Philadelphia. He orchestrated a boycott, very successful boycott, with the creation of the Legion of Decency, which basically every mad Catholic man took a pledge that they would not go to this type of movie. At that point, the Jews backed down. The Jews backed down because they were in debt, because they had just created talking pictures, 1929. Then the Depression comes. Then you have people who don't have any money. And so at this point, 1933, Harry Warner's losing $100,000 a week in Philadelphia alone. Now, that's real money in 1933. And that boycott threatened to spread throughout the entire, all of the big cities had huge Catholic populations, all the big cities in the Northeast. If it spread to them, Hollywood would have gone out of existence. And so Hollywood, the Jews in Hollywood backed down. They instituted a production code, which said no nudity, no blasphemy, none of this, no ridicule of the clergy, no propaganda for homosexuality. All of these issues were all in pre-code Hollywood films, and they were all being pushed, and Americans were upset. That code allowed the Catholics to basically hold the Jews in line for 32 years, 1965.
So this accounts for the frequent misconception that the Jews only took over Hollywood in the middle 1960s.
Absolutely not. No, the Jews created Hollywood. Neil Gobler wrote a book called A Kingdom of Their Own, How the Jews Created Hollywood. Now, if you say that, they'll call you an anti-Semite, but Neil Gobler can say it, and he can brag about it. So, no, we're talking, they basically stole Edison's invention, took it out to Hollywood, and created their own empire. And that by the 1920s, they were doing well. They were doing well, and that's when the reaction took place. Now, okay. 1965 is a significant year. It's a very significant year because 1965 is the year that the Jews broke the code. They broke the production code with a film called The Pawnbroker, which was basically Holocaust porn. They used the Holocaust. They tried to break the code in 64 with a sex farce called Kiss Me Stupid with Dean Martin and Kim Novak, and it didn't work. In Germany, they broke the code with a Bergman film called the Das Schweigen or Tischwagen or The Silence. But here, nobody watches foreign films, so it didn't work here. But then they rolled out the big guns by using the Holocaust. Now, this is important for another reason, because 65 is also the year that the Vatican Council ended. And right. One of the last documents to be passed was Nostra Aetate, which is the statement's church on non-Christian religions, but specifically the Jews. That's what happened. Both are happening at the same time.
Right, right. Yeah, so I'm going to ask all about Nostra Aetate in a little bit. But something else happened in 1965, which was Griswold versus Connecticut in the history of the Supreme Court. There is this usage of so-called substantive due process. Every 4 years, starting in 1965, there's some new act of political sexual subversion, political subjugation that was unleashed upon the American people. 65 was Griswold versus Connecticut, which said that it's basically a human right to have contraception. In 69, Stanley versus Georgia, which this makes more sense to me now after hearing your explanation. Stanley versus Georgia said, using substantive due process legal theory, that porn is essentially, it's illegal for any of the 50 states to make it illegal, universal right. 4 years after that, of course, you get 73 using the same substantive due process, Roe versus Wade. And so you get contraception, porn, and abortion, which are basically all Jewish weapons now.
Okay, The contraceptive crusade was a WASP operation. It was Protestant. Remember, Americans, the triple molly says Americans are Protestants, Catholics, and Jews. It's like Yugoslavia, three ethnic groups based on three religions at war with each other. So the Protestants were the first ones they were the ones behind the contraception crusade. It was the Jews were behind abortion. But that was later. So 65 was basically a Protestant WASP conspiracy to basically decriminalize the sale of contraception and overturn the Comstock Act, which had been created after after the Civil War because of the widespread pornography in army bases, stuff like that. Okay, so it overturned the Comstock Act, which also prohibited the sale of contraceptives. At that point, you had an alignment of forces. You had basically the Protestant-Jewish alliance, where they agreed that they wanted sexual liberation. And the classic example of that would be Paul Blanchard's book, American Freedom and Catholic Power, started as a bunch of articles in The Nation. Around 47, that's when the articles first appeared. The book appeared in 49. And this was basically, Blanchard was a Protestant minister who had completely succumbed to sexual vice, or called it sexual liberation. And so that was that angle of the thing. And they collaborated. They needed, in order to have some type of breakthrough on pornography, they had to have the cooperation of the Jews in Hollywood. And once they broke the code in 65, then pornography started becoming more and more intrusive until the point where now it's every kid has a cell phone where he can look at pornography.
Right, right. This terrible, terrible tragedy and weapon of subversion. How do we avoid underdetermination when we declare the Jews run the porn industry? They own most of the Pornhub and most of the porn sites. A lot of times it's a rabbi. If you look, they, you know, you get quotes by the famous, infamous Al Goldstein, the founder of Screw Magazine, saying, here's why the Jews run the porn industry. Cause we hate Jesus. We hate Catholicism. And this is a way of subverting the order. So that's one Jew admitting it. How do we, and I don't mean this as a devil's advocate, I mean it as a legitimate question in the exercise of the principle of sufficient reason. How can we say, especially when we're talking to skeptics, that the Jews run the porn industry and they run it toward a very specific end, a malicious end?
Yeah, well, the first thing you have to do is start quoting the Jews, who, yeah, as you say, Al Goldstein said, yes, of course, Jews run pornography. So I faced this issue. This is at the very beginning when I'm starting to write The Jewish Revolutionary Spirit. This is what I'm having to deal with. I have to deal with, first of all, what do you mean by the Jews? You know, that's something we have to deal with. It's a category issue. It's a philosophical issue. I had to deal with it because there was a kind of mystification. Every time you said the word Jew, nobody knew what you were talking about. And if you said the and Jews, as Dave Chappelle pointed out, you're automatically anti-Semitic, unless, of course, you say the Jews are very smart and they win many Nobel Prizes. So it's a completely double standard. So what I said, I had to take it back to the beginning of the Jews as we know them, which is the time of Jesus Christ when they arrive on this earth and they have to decide, are they going to accept the Messiah or not? And the Jews who accepted Jesus Christ as the Messiah are known as Christians. The Jews who rejected him are known as the Jews. What do I mean by the Jews? Do I mean all Jews? I mean the Jewish people, which is a political entity even under the Roman Empire. It was the head of it was the Sanhedrin. And the Jews, by which I mean this political entity, I do not mean every Jew or all Jews. I do not mean that the Blessed Mother shouted, crucify him. Obviously, she didn't. Obviously, there were Christians at this time who were following Jesus Christ, but the Jewish people killed Jesus Christ. And they ratified it solemnly when they said, his blood be on us and our people. So that's what the Jews did. And then if you start looking into it, there's all this evidence. So I went through all of the evidence of Jewish participation in pornography. It's in the Jewish Revolutionary Spirit, okay, and published it. And I got canceled. I was supposed to give a speech. The speech was immediately canceled. You can't say this. All sorts of abuse heaped on me because of doing this type of thing. And then finally, a professor in Abrams, Nathan Abrams, writes an article in the Jewish Quarterly in England, a scholarly journal, in which he says basically everything that I said. He read my book, okay? My book is footnoted. It's basically my book. And the only thing that got changed is every time I said pornography is bad, he says it's good. But the facts are all the same. This is indisputable now. It's only gotten more obvious with Solomon Friedman, now a rabbi, who is the director, owner, whatever you want to call it, of Pornhub, which became a monopoly, basically tried to become a monopoly on pornography through the internet. So it's really not a matter of dispute anymore. It's not a matter of dispute that pornography was controlled at the beginning by Jews, continues to be controlled by Jews, and they see it as part of their mission in life. If you listen to Rabbi Friedman, you know, why is a rabbi the head of a porn, the biggest porn operation in the world? Because we're supposed to think that this is a man of God and that therefore there is something, he's redeemed pornography and it's fit for polite company. That's the only reason he's involved. That's that simple.
Yeah. So this kind of bridges, conceptual bridge, for some of my questions involving the more general so-called Jewish question. My friend Joe Enders, who did a really good interview with you a little bit back, said they're just questions, JQ. Because of the sense we could use the term the partitively, or the sense in which we could use it generically to refer to an entire genus, we have to ask how ubiquitous is the Jewish revolutionary spirit. I know you're quick to rightly point out that St. John the Evangelist uses the Chappelle's favorite expression, the Jews, 71 times. And you say, well, it's being used at least partitively, but it seems to be the most powerful Jews that are being referred to. And even in Matthew's gospel, there is a clear designation that these are the people that are responsible for the deicide, the killing of God. So the Jews is used 71 times. Sounds somewhat ubiquitous to me. You insist it's not completely ubiquitous. But this is good, because then it means that when we're talking about the JQ, we don't have to talk about, necessarily speaking, categorically speaking, our nice neighbor down the street who doesn't mean us any harm, who might happen to be Jewish. But which Jews have the Jewish revolutionary spirit, and how do we like ascertain one from another?
All Jews have the Jewish revolutionary spirit.
All Jews,
by the fact that they are Jews. So you have to identify what is the identifying characteristic of a Jew. It can't be race. Okay, we have to eliminate that immediately, because the conflict out of which their identity emerged was a group of people that all shared the same DNA. It wasn't blacks versus white back then. It was a civil war among the Jews, between the Jews who accepted Jesus Christ and the Jews who rejected him. What does the rejection mean? What does it mean to reject Jesus Christ? Jesus Christ is the Logos incarnate. If you reject Jesus Christ, you're rejecting Logos, which is the order of the universe. You can't get this simply with the English translation when at the beginning of the Gospel of St. John. In the beginning, there was the Word was with God, and the Word is God. Because the Word does not render the term Logos in its fullness. If you look at the Greek word logos, there are pages after pages of English equivalent. So it means the order of the universe. It means rationality. It means discourse. It means all of these things taken together, and the Jews rejected all of them. Now, because they rejected the Logos incarnate, and they murdered the Logos incarnate. So if that is the case, that's their identity. Their identity is a purely negative identity, which is the rejection of Logos. And I'm saying it's across the board. That is the essence of Jewish identity. And so you can apply that to all Jews, okay? Who call after the crucifixion, after that crucial moment in history. So you can say, okay, they're religious Jews, you know, and you can say, okay, look, I met one of the leaders of Netarai Carter when I was in Iran. I said in front of the assembly there, I said, if all Jews were like Rabbi David here, we wouldn't be here. We wouldn't have these problems because they're just following the Talmud off by themselves and they just want to live in a ghetto and that's it. Well, wait a minute. The Talmud is also a rejection of Logos. And so it's just a different kind of rejection of Logos, okay? And it's a different reaction largely to the catastrophe of Shabbatai Zevi, the false Messiah, where the Jews basically just pulled out and went into hibernation in little ghettos in the shtetls in the Pale of the Settlement. But by the time of the 19th century, okay, the change that took place is that used to be on the eastern border of Poland. Poland disappeared. Now it's on the western border of Russia. And now you've got all these people who are speaking a kind of German being introduced to all these revolutionaries' ideas in Berlin. They don't speak Russian. They don't speak a Slavic language. They speak a dialect of German. And suddenly you have this awakening of the modern era of Judaism. And the two manifestations at this point are two revolutionary ideologies, Zionism, which is Jewish nationalism, and communism, which is Jewish internationalism. And there's a battle there between which group is going to be in the ascendancy. At the beginning, the dominant ideology was communism, socialism, Bolshevism, to be specific, and that's what caused the revolution that murdered the Tsar and turned Russia into the Soviet Union. But by 67, there were, for lots of reasons we could go into if you want, the mood among the Jews changed and they switched to Zionism, largely because of the 67 war. And Zionism, obviously now, with the fall of collapse of the Soviet Union, is now the dominant Jewish ideology in the world. Communism is going into eclipse.
Interesting. What do you want to say? Just a brief word on why this happened in 1967. I'd be interested.
Yeah, because of the Arab-Israeli war. Also, because at this point the Black-Jewish Alliance, known as the Civil Rights Movement, fell apart. There, Harold Cruz wrote a book called "The Crisis of the Negro Intellectual." He was a Jew. I'm sorry, he was a black guy, communist. Member of the communist Harlem branch of the Communist Party, and he wrote a book that had a tremendous effect. He was ended up being Black Studies, chairman of the Black Studies Department at the University of Michigan. And he said basically all of the black people that got into the Communist Party ended up working for the Jews for things that were only important to the Jews, and they neglected everything we had to do with our own black interests. That had a devastating effect. The Ocean Hill-Brownsville teacher strike in New York, where basically the blacks took over that school district and kicked all the Jewish teachers out. That also was 67, and of course the Arab-Israeli war. So at that point, the Black-Jewish Alliance, which was a powerful revolutionary movement in the United States that began with the founding of the NAACP, fell apart, and it was replaced by Zionism.
Yeah, the founder of the NAACP was Jewish, right? Or two Jewish men?
Yeah, the Spingarn brothers, two very influential Jews. They created the NAACP and as a way of defeating black nationalism, which was rising at that point. The great leader of black nationalism was Marcus Garvey. Marcus Garvey went to the NAACP headquarters and he said, there are no blacks here. It's only Jewish lawyers. And then they created their front man, their black front man, W.E.B. Du Bois, the Harvard graduate. And the main job was to destroy Marcus Garvey, to destroy any type of black nationalism and replace it with integration. And, of course, the great crusade for integration happened after Brown versus School Board, 1954, which ignited the Civil Rights Movement, which basically was a revolutionary movement, certainly in the South. It overthrew the governments of the South.
Indeed, absolutely. The way I knew of NAACP's founding by the Jewish brothers was through the work of Myron Fagan. Just a passing question. What do you think of the work of Myron Fagan on the?
I'm not familiar with this work.
Really does an excellent. You can even listen to the lecture in under 3 hours on the Council on Foreign Relations, which is basically a Rothschild plant in America, and it was one of the voices, one of the efficient causes of my kind of opening my eyes over the last 2 to 3 years, along with your work and some others. So you should look into it, particularly. Yeah. The lecture by Myron Fagan that's been recorded from, I think, an album, a record album originally onto YouTube, Council on Foreign Relations. It's excellent. And I think you'd know a lot about what he's talking about and how it'd be concomitant with a lot of what he's saying. If we can, let's just back out a little bit, because I do want to zero back in a minute. But anti-Semitism is, by all means, probably intentionally, the most ill-defined term in the political lexicon in popular, cultural politics, political economy today. Is there any extant definition for anti-Semitism that qualifies, in your book, or the book of A Reasonable Man, as intellectually honest?
Yes. Yeah, Joe Soberin once said that an anti-Semite used to be someone who didn't like Jews, and now is someone Jews don't like. So anti-Semitism is basically any speech that Jews don't like, even if objectively it's something that the Jew himself would say. And I just gave you that. So I can say the Jews are behind gay marriage. People say that's anti-Semitic. Well, I got it from Amy Dean, who said that in a magazine, Jewish magazine called Tikkun. So that's the crisis that we're facing right now. Now, we are now coming up on the 60th anniversary of Nostra Aetate, okay? And what's happened is discussions like this have basically undermined one of the principal fruits of Nostra Aetate, which is Catholic-Jewish dialogue. It has been a catastrophe for the church and for the world because of this idea that we now have to pretend the Jews are our friends. This has never been in the position of the Catholic Church. The position of the Catholic Church was always based on what St. Paul said in 1 Thessalonians 2. The Jews are the people. Remember, not all Jews. The Jews are the people who killed Christ and are enemies of the entire human race. That has been the standard position. When you try and work that out, you can end up with the articles in Civiltà Cattolica, that you mentioned, which is, this is the official magazine of the Vatican, 100 years after the French Revolution, trying to come up with an analysis of what happened to their country. And it comes to this stunning conclusion, which is basically that any country that turns away from the laws that were enacted by Christian leaders, princes, will end up being ruled by Jews. That was the state in France. That's at a time when the Catholic Church was capable of dealing with an issue like this, with the Jewish question. It's enlightening, and I think it's also encouraging, because the Catholic Church was at one point capable of doing this, and now the church is not capable of doing it. And the proof of that is this failed experiment known as Catholic-Jewish dialogue. And one of the most recent, I'll say the most recent example of this is that statement issued by the Bishops' Conference, the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops, in conjunction with the American Jewish Committee. It's a document called Translate Hate, basically in which a bishop, Bishop Bombera of Scranton, now this is him giving his name approval to a bunch of bureaucrats, both in the AJC and the USCCB, who have basically said, we as Catholics now have to endorse this lexicon of forbidden terms. Which under pain of, by under the way, pain of sin, under pain of sin.
They say that even to utter the word clannish or cowardice is often anti-Semitic. It's unreal. The bishops imply that it's anti-Semitic to cite any of the original eight doctors. We had eight doctors, four East, four West, before we got like lots and lots of doctors of the church. If you cite any of them, Chrysostom or Jerome or Augustine or Ambrose or any of the others on the Jews, you're an anti-Semite. If you make any reference to the blood curse in the gospel, then you're an anti-Semite. And I guess the only saving grace is that the USCCB is not magisterial. What do we make of this?
Well, first of all, the USCCB has not approved this document. They haven't initiated the document. They're going to propose this, I think, for a vote on the bishops, and I think that they're going to reject it. That we went down this road before with Bishop Cardinal Keeler of Baltimore, who was a total pawn of the Jews, issued a statement that was horrendous, basically handed over the entire farm, and it was never approved. It was never issued formally by the USCCB. So I think that's the situation. But the fact that it got this far is some indication of there's a serious problem here. There is a serious problem. Never in the history of the Catholic Church has a bishop dared to tell a Catholic there are certain words that you're not allowed to use, much less words that were created by the American Jewish Committee. This is an outrageous violation of the freedom of the gospel, which we all we profit from, because at the beginning, St. Paul stood up to St. Peter and said, no, no, we are not going to impose Jewish practices or Jewish fables on the Catholic people. I can't state with enough emphasis what a violation of the Catholic faith this is, what a violation of the fundamental principles of Catholic tradition this horrendous document is.
You have somewhat more faith in the USCCB than I do. My only solace is that no matter what they do, because they'll back anything awful these days, it's not actually, it has no magisterial weight. I'm more concerned by that which does have magisterial weight, Nostra Aetate, which I want to talk about in just one second. But first, in the first article that you republished here on Fidelity Press, and I do urge everyone to order this from Fidelity Press, from Dr. Jones. It's really, really eye-opening. The first article makes the argument that the church recognizes that Talmudic Jews, as opposed to Mosaic Jews, Jews that practiced Mosaism and eventually became Christians, always form a state within a state. Can you just break down quickly this argument in the first article? Why did the Jews always form a state within a state, and they're always patriotic to a foreign entity from that diaspora nation that they're currently residing in?
Well, this is a crucial point, because the man responsible for the emancipation of Jews was Napoleon. And Napoleon, this is like the beginning, 1804 or something like that. Napoleon wants to conquer Russia, so he needs to get through the Pale of the Settlement. So I assume he wants support, Jewish support. So he goes to the Jews, and the first question is, will you support the French people? And they say, of course, jusque la mort, unto death, we will support the French people. Well, they lied. By the time Napoleon got back from the Battle of Jena, the people in Strasbourg were complaining that the Jews had already started to exploit their situation as citizens. No country in the world had ever granted citizenship to the Jews. No country before Napoleon did it. And now, 100 years later, Civita Cattolica is taking telling the story of the disaster that has created for them. Well, they only can only represent their own interest. This is clear. It was clear to them. And now, if we needed any justification, any type of reinforcement for this idea, look at the Biden administration. The Biden administration had at its top a man who got progressively more senile and incompetent as time went on. But there were 457 Jews in the Biden administration that Jewish newspapers were referring to as Biden's minion. None of those Jews were representing the interest of the American people. And this came out, and there were Senate hearings. When they brought Mayorkas in, Alejandro Mayorkas, who's head of Homeland Security, He's opening the borders. He was the head of the Hebrew Immigrant Aid Society. That's the group of people he was representing. He was representing their interests. Not one Jew was able to represent the interest of the American people. And I think that we have to have a debate now about citizenship. What does citizenship mean? Does it mean anything? What did Mayorkas do? What was his plan? To basically flood the country with immigrants, send them to California, where Newsom will say, they don't have to register. You're going to do me a crime if you ask some guy who shows up with no identification and you don't allow him to vote. We have completely, because of the Jewish influence in the Biden administration, the whole idea of citizenship has completely eroded, because the only thing these people know how to represent is their own tribal interest. Whether it's Blinken, whether it's Mayorkas, whether it's, we had the example of the head Merrick Garland, the head of the Department of Justice, who as soon as he gets in office, starts going after pro-lifers. Mr. Houck, Mark Houck from Bucks County, just outside of Philadelphia. FBI shows up with drawn guns at 5 o'clock in the morning. His entire family, 9 children and wife, have to come out in their night clothes while the FBI arrests their husband. This is an outrageous miscarriage of justice. Why did it happen? Because Mark Houck was pro-life. He was a big pro-life leader in eastern Pennsylvania. And abortion is a Jewish sacrament. Yeah. It's that simple. They announced this after Roe versus Wade. So he's imposing his religion on the rest of us by arresting Mark Houck and trying to send a wave of fear through every Catholic in the country.
For skeptics out there that are saying, oh, wait a minute, is abortion actually a Jewish sacrament? It's something like 400 Jewish political action groups or lobbies came out and said themselves, abortion is a Jewish value. Isn't that right?
A fundamental Jewish value. The words, I'm the one who said sacrament. I'm the guy who created that meme, if you want to call it. Because that's what it is. I mean, if you're honest, that's what it is. But they said, 400 Jewish organizations said abortion is a fundamental Jewish value in the wake of overturning Roe versus Wade. Now, they never said that in 1973. And we know that because Bernard Nathanson was one of the Jews, along with Lawrence Lederer, who got the law in New York overturned. Whenever the New York Times mentioned Bernard Nathanson, they said he was a gynecologist. Never once did they say he was a Jew. Never once did anyone ever say abortion is a fundamental Jewish value. I said it's a sacrament because now there's a law going through the courts in Indiana where Jews are asking for a religious exemption to circumvent Indiana's abortion law. That means it's part of your religion. And if it's part of your religion, I'm going to call it a sacrament.
That's interesting. Yeah, to get around the post-Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health jurisprudence, they're trying to get a religious exemption is
that's Jewish. Exactly right. Yes. So what does that tell you? What does that tell you about? What does it tell? Let's be honest here. If abortion is one of your fundamental values, are you worshiping Yahweh? No.
No.
What was the God that demanded child sacrifice? It was Moloch.
Yep.
And this is the God, the Jews have proven that they worship Moloch by saying abortion is a fundamental Jewish value. Now, when is the Catholic Church going to wake up to this fact? When are they going to stop pretending that Jews are our friends? They are our elder brothers or whatever you want to say, whatever you want to say. This is not the case. And we have to wake up to reality.
Amen. One more quick question before we get to Nostra Aetate, because it's deeply problematic. I think I might view it as even a little more problematic than you do. But recently, I'm sure you saw this, Representative Massey did this interview with Tucker and shocked the world by claiming, and he's one of the only congressmen that I actually trust, that every single other member of Congress, even the Republicans besides him, had an AIPAC handler. How did that come to pass, assuming that it's true? How could that possibly happen?
One step at a time. The short answer is money. okay? And what you had with the Reagan administration is a huge infusion of money into Jewish hands, largely because of the leveraged buyouts on Wall Street at this time. This is usury. The Jew will lend you money and then eventually take over your operation. That's how the Jews work. That's what they did. And so Reagan, at this point, this is, I'm not making this up. This is Midge Dechter's memoir called An Old Wife's Tale. Midge Dechter was the wife of Norman Podaris. They were the power couple during the high watermark of neoconservatism, which was a Jewish operation in the 1980s. And she was shocked that the Jews were invited into the Republican Party. She said, we thought they all hated us. Well, maybe they do hate you, but they saw that you had a lot of money. And so Reagan allowed the leverage buyouts, which basically was the looting and destruction of America's industrial base. The greatest industrial base in the history of the world. It was the creation of people like Henry Ford in Detroit. And the Jews were allowed to buy these companies up for whatever it was, with cheap junk bonds, load them down with debt, and then steal the money. And then the company goes belly up, and suddenly 500 people in town are out of work, and the plant went to Mexico. This is one of the great scandals. It was the Reagan administration that allowed to do it. And the result was huge amounts of money, so much money that now they can buy the government. So we have the new system is $1, one vote. $1, one vote. And I think, to be honest with you, one of the prime examples of this is Donald Trump. Yeah. I think he firmly believes in $1, one vote. Did you notice who sat next to him? How do you get to sit at the right hand of the father? Well, Elon Musk sat at the right hand of the father, and it cost him about $300 million. Miriam Adelson maybe could sit a few steps down. She only gave $100 million. This is the way the Jews have taken over our system. It was usury. I've written a book about this called Barren Metal, The Conflict Between Labor and Usury as the History of Capitalism. This is the way they've done it. And now they have so much money, they bought off every single member of Congress except for, looks like, Representative Massey.
Unbelievable. Okay, so that's shocking stuff. I mean, that was a big moment when he said that. And you can see even on Tucker Carlson's face noticing, and a red pill moment, because it's so sweeping. And so I guess the thing I come back to, Dr. Jones, is the sweeping language. There's a tension between those two words, split right between them, the and Jews. Is it partitive? Is it universal? Okay, not all of the Jews committed deicide, but there's some sort of...
No, wait a minute. All of the Jews committed suicide. Not all Jews committed suicide. Deicide, I'm sorry. All of the Jews, by the fact that they are the Jewish people, ratified by their leadership and so on and so forth, the Jews are responsible for the death of Christ. That's exactly what St. Paul says in 1 Thessalonians 2. The Jewish people, that's what he's referring to. That's what I'm saying, is the Jews. It is not synonymous with all Jews.
But you said, but all Jews have the Jewish revolutionary spirit. How is this commutative? What's the commutative property? I it's a tricky question.
Because that's their identity. Okay. By the very fact that you are a Jew, you are in rebellion against the Logos. That is that is the identity now after the crucifixion. The codification of this identity is the Talmud, which came into existence 300 to 500 years after the crucifixion. This is, the Jewish Encyclopedia says the Talmud is the heart of Jewish identity. And I agree with them. Mm-hmm. Okay. That is the heart. That's the split that took place after that moment. Okay. The people with Jewish DNA that followed Jesus Christ were not considered Jews anymore. It's in the Gospel of St. John. If you go to the passage where the parents of the man born blind, refused to speak out of fear of the Jews, because the Jews threatened to expel from the synagogue anyone who said that Jesus Christ was the Messiah. Well, the parents of the man born blind had the same DNA. What do they mean? By this time in the gospel, the Jews are the people who killed Christ. They are not. It doesn't have anything to do with DNA anymore. It's the rebellion against Logos, the killing of Christ, that has given the Jews their new identity.
Okay, so that's a good answer, and thanks for the clarification. In the Vatican II document, let me back this up with a little context. Nostra Aetate is one of the sacred constitutions from Vatican II. For people out there who are forgetting, we have declaratios, we have constitutions, and we have shorter writs. Three kinds of basic document coming out of the Second Vatican Council. I think 16 in total. I was 3 years back planning, researching, writing a Vatican II book, making pro-textualist, anti-intentionalist defenses of the documents. In other words, use a sort of original public meaning, which is the heart of textualism, to interpret these documents that a lot of my fellow trads get spun off about. Dignitatis Humanae, Lumen Gentium, Gaudium et Spes. They get spun off because they're giving a Stanley Fish intentionalist read of the documents because maybe there was a bad intention, but that's the wrong way to parse a document. You go with the original public meaning because it's a ratified text, and the original public meaning is what was ratified publicly by the thousands of bishops who ratified these documents. So as a matter of fact, I think you can show with Dignitatis, Lumen Gentium, Gaudium et Spes, a textualist read of the documents vindicates that even though there's some fishiness in the language and some squishiness and some universalism and some religious indifferentism being insinuated at times, ultimately the documents come out technically orthodox and we shouldn't have a problem with them. I was planning this book. It's going to be my fifth book. But what defeated my vigors, my effort, was Nostra Aetate. And I just said, I don't know, this feels, I'm a trained philosopher, I'm not a theologian, I'm not an ecclesiologist for the church, so I don't want to do this anymore. Nostra Aetate, even though there are some fishy passages in Dignitatis Lumen Gaudium, Nostra Aetate feels like a horse of a different color. Even a textualist can't get around a few of the lines perfectly cleanly. I'm not saying that it's a false document or anything like that. I just said, this is not worth the headache. You went over a few of these on Red Top Report with Joe Enders, and I agreed with your analysis that there are a couple lines that are really touch and go, but do come out orthodox in the wash. A couple of the lines where it's actually insinuated in one line that the church does replace the Jews as the people of God, even as the bishops are, who wrote the thing are trying to say the other one. But here's one that bothers me a lot. I want to hear what you say about this. I think this is in the fourth section of Nostra Aetate. Paul maintains that the Jews remain very dear to God for the sake of the patriarchs, since God does not take back gifts he bestowed or choices he made. This is in contradistinction to the points you made with Joe Enders and you've made in several places about replacement theology. This sounds more like dual covenant, strongly. What do you think of that? God does not.
No, you're right. They do. They come out for supersessionism. Not all Jews at the time of Christ called for his death. Okay, which means some of them did, and that this is now the new. They talk about the church as the new covenant, something like that. There are terms like that. The words are escaping me at this point.
I'll get it.
Basically, I think that the historical research I did was that there was a clear attempt to subvert the Second Vatican Council. Two documents in particular. One of them was Nostra Aetate, and it was orchestrated by the American Jewish Committee. By the way, the same group that Bishop Bamber just endorsed, okay, and B'nai B'rith. And they hired, they had a double agent by the name of Malachi Martin, who was working for these Jewish organizations with one goal in mind, and that was to exonerate the Jews from responsibility for the death of Christ. That failed. It's not going to happen. You're not going to put a document in front of 2,000 bishops, certainly at that period of time, and say the Jews did not kill Christ. They rejected it, and they were disappointed, and there was lots of testimony afterwards about how disappointed they were. But as I said before, there are statements in there that absolutely need to be clarified. And one of them is the church opposes all forms of anti-Semitism. What does that mean? I'm saying they didn't define this term because every single bishop at that point in Rome knew what anti-Semitism meant, and it didn't mean to be defined. Anti-Semitism was biological determinism. Every bishop knew that. That's what the term, Wilhelm Marr created the term in 1871 because he didn't want to talk about, he wanted to talk about Darwinism rather than theology. So that's what it meant. It makes no sense, as I said before, from a Catholic perspective, because everybody had the same DNA, and so we couldn't. You can't explain this by that. They need to define this document. Now jump ahead to translate hate, and guess what, Bishop? It's as if Bishop Bombera heard what I said. I'm going to define it. What does he do? He takes the Jewish definition, the International Holocaust Remembrance Association definition of anti-Semitism, which begins, anti-Semitism is a certain perception. Well, I'm sorry, but I don't know what your perceptions are. I can't judge your perceptions, and no one can make a certain perception the basis of some type of law or dogma in the Catholic Church. That's impossible. And so the church needs to repudiate this document, the Bambera document, and they need to come up and state what I just said. At the time, anti-Semitism clearly meant biological determinism. The church has never espoused any form of biological determinism, period. Never.
I'm with you. We need a clear definition of anti-Semitism, which anyone is loath to offer ever, as used in Nostra Aetate. But what about this line? I didn't hear you talk about this in any of the other interviews you've given. From Nostra, which says, God does not take back gifts he bestowed or choices he made. This seems to contradict the supersessionism.
No, if you take it in context, it doesn't. Because in a sense, what is the situation now? Can Jews be saved? Is there, so if you keep hearing about this, the curse. Are Jews cursed, which means that they're determined by God to go to hell? No, absolutely not. Jews can be saved, but now they're saved the same way everyone else is saved, which is by baptism. Baptism is necessary for salvation. This was one of the dumbest things ever to come out of the Catholic Church, a mouth of a bishop, was Bishop Barron talking to Ben Shapiro. And Ben Shapiro says, well, am I screwed? Basically, am I screwed? By which he means to say, am I going to hell? And Bishop Barron cited Nostra Aetate, had no basis for this, okay? And then he gets into this thing about invincible ignorance, which does not apply to Ben Shapiro in any way, shape, or form. It may be to the Yanomamo in 500 BC. I mean, that's invincible ignorance, but not Ben Shapiro. He knows what he's talking about. He's wondering about Jesus Christ. And so what Bishop Barron should have said is, have you been baptized? Well, the answer is obviously no. And then, well, Ben, if you refuse to be baptized, you cannot be saved. It's that simple. Baptism is necessary for salvation. That's what they have to get back to. The fact that he can't is an indication of the crisis that is facing the church right now, because they are denying the gospel. If they're saying that a Jew can be saved without being baptized, they are denying the gospel. And it seems to me that is the dominant ideology at the USCCB. It's called dual covenant theology. I say this because Reverend Massa met with Bob Sungenis, who wanted an imprimatur from Bishop Rhodes. And during that meeting, he told Sungenis, no one believes in supersessionism anymore. Mm-hmm. That's a crisis. That supersessionism means the Jews have been replaced as gods. The new covenant is with, we are the children of Moses. The Catholic Church are the children of Moses. The Jews have been replaced. It's the parable of the wicked husbandman. It says it clearly in the gospel. That doesn't mean that Jews cannot be saved, But they have to be saved the same way everyone else is saved, which is by accepting baptism.
But I think Barron would point at this little subordinate clause. Since God does not take back gifts he bestowed or choices he made, this is dangerous. Now, that's right out of Nostra Aetate. Yeah, he does. If we believe in supersessionism, then God does take back the kind of gift of grace that was conferred upon the people of God in the Old Testament. And now you have to get baptized.
We have to be specific. The Mosaic covenant is no longer valid. Okay, so if that's what you mean by gifts, okay, well, I don't think that's what the church means. The crucial factor here is everything in these documents, every ambiguous statement has to be interpreted in light of tradition.
Right, correct.
And once you put that lens in, then I think it comes out in the wash, as you said. Yeah. What we have is a reversal now of that principle, which is basically we have to view tradition in light of Vatican II. That's the problem right now. Especially when it comes to the Jewish question, because when you get this crazy interpretation of, the Jewish question, crazy interpretation of certain passages that basically nullifies the entire mission of the Catholic Church, which is to go out and baptize all people.
Right, right. Well, this is an ugly sticking point over the last 60 years because I've always been traditionalist, I'm considered of traditionalist rank, if you have to categorize, but I've always been the traditionalist that's like the hermeneutic of continuity is what you apply as an interpretive aid. And it's not the conformative to the stupid horse drawing that other trads will use to mock the hermeneutic as if it's an impossibly lenient scrutiny that you have to apply. It's actually not, with stuff like the Muslims and the Buddhists that are being cited in other documents like Lumen Gentium and Dignitatis Humanae and Gaudium et Spes. I'm forgetting which one. I mean, if you look at even recent tradition and magisterium in the church, they get mad because one of those documents calls Muslims Muslims worship the one God. Well, in the personal catechism of Pius X, one of my favorite popes and definitely one of the favorite popes of SSPX types, he says that Muslims worship the one true God. He says the exact same thing. So that is not, in my view, or I think yours, like a stupidly lenient scrutiny where you're applying such a lenient scrutiny involved by your hermeneutic that it dissolves all meaning. I think both you and I agree on that. When I read a line like the one, God doesn't take back choice, the gifts he bestowed, I get uncomfortable. That feels like a new level of meaning dissolving scrutiny you would have to apply to make it comport with tradition. Same thing with this line from that cites Ephesians 2 from Nostra Aetate. It says, the church believes that Christ, who is our peace, has through his cross reconciled Jews and Gentiles and made them one in himself. Well, I mean, if they're baptized Jews, then they're one in himself. They're not.
Well, that's what he means. I mean, of course that's what it means. It doesn't mean that people who are in rebellion against God are reconciled with the people who accept him as their savior. No, it can't mean that. This is why I say you have to interpret it in light of tradition. It's obvious what that means in light of tradition. That means basically that if you come from these background, the crucial crisis at the beginning of the church was, how are the Jews going to merge with the Greeks? How are we going to deal with this? St. Paul went and started talking to the Greeks. How are we going to bring these two things together? Can we bring these two things together? Are Greeks going to be second-class citizens? That's what this passage is about.
I hope you're right. I do. There are these other lines that I've heard you deal with elsewhere where I agree the scrutiny that you have to apply to make the ostensible tension go away isn't absurd, like the line in Nostra. The Jewish authorities and those who followed their lead pressed for the death of Christ. Still, what happened in his passion cannot be charged against all the Jews without distinction, then alive, nor against the Jews of today. I mean, I don't think there's a big problem there.
No, there's no problem at all. No problem at all there.
Sure. Okay. Call it no problem. You've also dealt with this. Although the church is the new people of God, which is an admission of supersessionism, which you
Of
point out.
course. Of
The
course.
Jews should not be presented as rejected or accursed by God because they can get baptized, right? So I think you're
Right.
right. I think you're
Right.
right. I'm just more bothered by the two lines I've produced here, but I
The
certainly hope you're right about.
fundamental problem is Catholic Jewish dialogue. It's this superstructure that got built on Nostra Aetate, has been a disaster, has no magisterial value. Nostra Aetate is part of the magisterium. Catholic Jewish dialogue is a policy. It has no magisterial value whatsoever. And it's a failed experiment. And we have to admit it. And we have to just say, that's it. No more. We're going back to the traditional position.
But I mean, do you see? Because I know you're a doctor of literature, correct?
Right.
In interpretation.
Yes.
So, I mean, are you familiar with Stanley Fish, who's kind of
Yes, he was my
father?
teacher. He taught me.
I thought you knew him. So, and in intentionalism is where one scrutinizes ends up being important in one of my two areas of expertise, which is constitutional interpretation. Dr. Fish said that you should interpret a text. Where does the meaning inhere? And he says that it really inheres in the intent of the author. And this he passed off as a kind of originalism. The
No,
problem with
wait,
this
wait,
is.
wait, stop, stop. He said the reader creates the text. That was his big claim to fame. He wasn't
Original.
the author. The reader creates the text.
No, but in the fundamental difference between. Any other text, whether it's a periodical or even a joint authored fiction, novel, nonfiction, the fundamental difference between a ratified text where you don't have la cosa nostra unless you have, you don't have a thing. It's not reified unless you have some quorum of ratifiers who become secondary authors. And all the other texts that don't require ratification is this fundamental problem of the intent of the small cabal, another anti-Semitic term according to the USCCB, the small cabal of drafters, if they use with a wink and a nod to each other words that are susceptible of two meanings, which is all words, and they say, we're going to pass this off to the 2 or 3,000 ratifiers as meaning something innocuous, but we mean something subversive, and we're going to lean on the subversive meanings later. This is what I mean by intentionalism, and this is
Okay.
the correct way to interpret Vatican II.
Can I say something right now? I have to take a break right now. If you want to continue, I'll be happy to continue, but I got to take a break. And do you want me to come back?
I'd love to have you back maybe a different day, because I'd love to talk to you about what you said about math.
I'd be happy to answer that question. Stanley Fish was my teacher, but I got to break off. We've been doing this for over an hour. I only expected to be on for an hour.
Okay,
But
nope.
I have to break off at this point. So I can come back if you want, or I can come back at another time and we can continue the discussion.
Let's do it another day. I'd love to talk to you
Okay.
about Fish, and
Okay.
Malik Martin
Let's
himself. Thank you.
we'll come back for another day and we'll begin with Stanley Fish and that whole corruption of literary criticism that I watched from a front row seat. We can talk about that too.
Excellent. All right. Thanks for your time. Sorry we went over an hour. I think it was a really productive conversation. And thanks for your work. Where can people find you? Fidelity Press?
Go to
Fast.
fidelitypress.org. Fidelitypress.org. Do not go to Amazon. I've been banned from Amazon.
Yeah, this is a great little book at fidelitypress.org. Thank you for all your work, Dr. E. Michael Jones. Thanks for agreeing to come on today. And I'll see you soon again. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
God bless you.
Peace.
Peace.